Mayor Lenny Curry disbands the Port Dredging Task Force, Duval County okays self-defense in schools, and the state proposes new congressional district maps. Those are just some of the stories making headlines this week. Good morning, live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Jessica Palumbo, in for Melissa Ross. First Coast Connect is always live on the radio and now subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. Just ahead, the news of the week with our Friday roundtable. Then later, tips from a pediatrician for back to school. And a shark festival is taking over the Jacksonville Zoo and Gardens starting tonight. All of that's ahead. But first, it's Friday. That means it's time for our weekly roundtable. Here with me in studio are Fred Matthews with The Examiner. Good morning.
Good morning, Jessica.
Good morning. Tim Gibbons is here, editor of Jacksonville Business Journal. Good morning, Tim.
Good to be here.
And A.G. Yankarski with Folio Weekly and Florida Politics is here.
Hello, Jessica.
Good morning, guys. Thanks for being here. We begin today with some news from City Hall, as Mayor Lenny Curry this week dissolved the task force created by his predecessor, Mayor Alvin Brown, to examine the controversial St. John's River dredging project. Curry says his administration will work directly with Jacksport to see the $700 million project through. The task force had yet to issue a final report on its findings or a recommendation for how the city would pay for its share of that project. At the same time, the mayor's transition committees presented dozens of recommendations yesterday, including building more fire stations and unifying neighborhoods with a neighborhood department at City Hall. To our callers, what do you think about all this news from Mayor Curry's administration? Join our conversation at 549-2937 or send us an email at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org or comment on our Facebook page. Gentlemen, let's first start with this port project. And does this mean the port is getting closer to being deepened?
No. Let me go out on a limb there and go, the dissolving of the task force really doesn't say anything really one way or the other about whether it will happen. It does say something about the Curry administration and how it wants to approach things. The task force was always kind of an odd animal in that very accomplished people on it, people who have deep knowledge of transportation and business in general, not necessarily a lot of environmental knowledge, but it was never really clear what their role was. The city obviously supported dredging. Business community supports it. Political community supports it. Nobody could ever tell us, why do we need this task force?
Well, we needed a task force because it always provides great political cover to the elected officials. Put a task force together. Let them hash it out. Let the environmental people have a couple of seats on it and so they can have a say.
Right.
But the Curry administration basically says we don't need a task force. Why do we need that? I don't care what their opinion is.
Well, but that's the thing. It's not like the task force was going to come out and say we shouldn't dredge.
No.
I mean, not who cares what their opinion is, but if their opinion isn't a surprise, their opinion doesn't matter.
Who's the environmentalist on the Jacksonville Port Authority? AG knows.
The previous administration used task forces for everything. Blue ribbon panels. They ran on that in 2011, 2015. You still had a lot of problems unsolved, and you still had task forces. Lenny Curry is very close to Jacksport. You know, he's through the campaign. He feels like he can make this happen. You know, he's going to go up to D.C. to lobby for money. Going to go to Tallahassee to lobby for money. And you know, I think that's the move because really the port project's not held up by any environmental concerns. It's held up by lack of funding, and getting that funding piece is, you know, job one for the Curry administration because they need those jobs up there, and they see dredging as the road there. And we've, of course, talked about how there's a lot of competition for a limited amount of imports.
That was the funny bit with this idea of the dissolving them now before they answer the question of how they think it should be funded, because that's really the only important question that they had, that they, you know, members of the task force were asked along this process, so how is this going to be done? It was, well, we'll answer that in September. Well, oh, shucks. They're going to dissolve before they can answer the only important question that matters.
Maybe they didn't have an answer.
No.
All right. Next, at City Hall yesterday, Curry's 9 transition committees released dozens of recommendations for him to study. The groups have been meeting for hours to craft their suggestions, which they presented to him in a 120-page report. Number one, most recommended, bring back the disbanded neighborhood department. And what does the neighborhood department do?
Well, the neighborhood department would look at everything from parks to senior and social services, things like that, basically bring things under an umbrella the way it was during previous administrations. That was something that disbanded in recent years. And it's something that a few of these committees kept coming back to as something needed. And, you know, it's sort of a back to the future approach from the Curry administration, bringing back the Peyton and Delaney alumni. And, you know, they want to get the structure of government back to what it was, back to what they're comfortable with. And, you know, they've, throughout this process, the transition in the early part of their administration, they've looked at organization and how to revise the org chart. And now the question, of course, is will council buy in? Will it be budgeted and so forth? But it's something where our neighborhoods department is probably going to happen in the first term.
The great irony is when Brown came in, that was one of his three pillars were reform government, reform pensions, and I forget what the third one is. sorry. But the government restructuring, I deeply covered that. And it was one of these like constant, just iteration after iteration. It took, I want to say, 2 years to actually have the new structure in place. That's halfway through the term. Now, there is the blueprint that the Curry administration is kind of picking up from previous administrations, but how long is this going to take now to make government in their image? You know, then they're halfway through the term. It is a weird cycle in mayoral politics.
Well, I doubt if it'll take that long because we have a love fest going on between the city council and the mayor at this point.
It helps.
It helps. The finance committee chairman is fine with it. They had a gathering this week on another issue, but you had a Democratic city councilman, new. Miss Brown was there with him and the sheriff touting a program to help black young men across the county. So I think it'll move through. I think we'll see most of this, with the exception, even this chief philanthropy officer here, person who's going to give out money.
What is the chief philanthropy officer?
The idea is that...
give away money from the government? Or how is that going to work?
What's happening is that, first of all, this can be funded by the nonprofits the first year. So it's revenue neutral, at least to launch. And the idea is that we haven't been aggressive enough in going after grants as a city. It's hurt the nonprofit community. It's hurt what we've been able to do on that level. And the idea is that a chief philanthropy officer will pay for itself. And that's the bet that's being made. So it's
there was talk about this during the Brown administration. Yeah. They never could get it together. And that idea of, you know, the journey, for example, should not be city funded to the sense that it should be, you know, it's grants that the city's getting that go to the journey.
And right.
Well, how much is the chief philanthropy officer going to be paid? Is he going to be in a $90,000 range to put together these coalitions? Because, you know, again, during the last administration, there was a monthly, if not quarterly, meeting of nonprofits held over at the Ed Ball Center, where they all got together and at least had a chance to ask questions of the mayor and go back and forth. So what's going to be the difference here? We're not going to have the quarterly meeting, but you're going to pay this guy to go look for grants for the federal government?
Well, you're going to have a direct line. I mean, that's the idea. You're going to have somebody that's got access to the upper administration that the nonprofits can talk to more. And you're also going to have somebody who's responsible for the grant applications and things like that, because the complaint is that it just hasn't happened enough and our nonprofit sector has suffered.
Common wisdom amongst nonprofits is, you know, grant writer pays for itself. If they're doing their job well, that's money, you know, they're a revenue raiser.
Right.
We're here with our media roundtable discussing recommendations to Mayor Curry by his transition committees. What would your recommendations be for the mayor as he transitions and creates the budget for the city? Call in 549-2937. And also, a couple of recommendations included in that report are to build more fire stations, increasing public safety in a couple of areas of town, by Old Middleburg Road at Collins Road on the west side, and also at the St. John's Town Center, explosive growth in those areas.
Right. And, you know, one of the things that came out of yesterday's meeting was that our fire coverage is uneven throughout the city. Some parts have very good fire coverage that's really good for homeowners insurance. Conversely, some parts are underserved. That's bad for homeowners insurance. And the idea is to bolster fire coverage. They're also going to bolster engines and things like that. So, I mean, that's a priority going forward, bolstering fire and rescue.
Any other big takeaways from those transition reports?
You know, a lot of this stuff has already been incorporated in what the Curry administration is doing. I mean, it hasn't been just a closed process because, you know, the people running the transition committees, you know, are part of the administration in many ways, except for Susie Wiles. And, You know, basically, a lot of the stuff has already been worked into the game plan, and it's not surprising. It's sort of the John Delaney playbook, you know, brought to the 21st century.
The interesting corollary to that, though, to go back to the Port Task Force, one of the things that's been interesting about the transition is that they have been in public, despite the initial kind of questioning about whether they would be. But having the conversations in public and getting to this point helps in getting acceptability, having people embrace things. The mayor working directly with Jaxport takes away that level of transparency, and it will be interesting to see if that creates some sort of friction.
Yeah.
And, AG, you were talking about some funding for infrastructure, and is that something that the mayor is looking at fixing some problems with roads and sidewalks as well?
Well, he's got a capital improvement plan that's pretty ambitious, something we talked about when the budget came out, sort of five-year plans for things like sidewalks and roads and things like that. But, you know, the impression I got yesterday is that it needs to be expedited a little bit because there's supposedly $140 million in deferred maintenance, sidewalks, roads, et cetera. I mean, things like Liberty Street are a good example of it.
Yeah.
You go outside, you see sidewalks and roads with potholes that become sinkholes in some places. And, you know, this is true throughout the city, except maybe in a new construction area. So, you know, when you look at that, it's something that the current administration is going to have to figure out a way to pay for in the first term.
All right. And here's a suggestion from a caller. Pat is on the line from St. Mary's. Pat, you're on the air.
You know, bringing some startup accelerators, such as specifically the Bunker, which is a military veteran space, but you have other startup accelerators. Take that Jacksonville landing. Bring those startups there. Right-size that building so you have micro-businesses in there. Partner with some of the universities and get some of this dynamic business that One Spark seems to excite and bring it to Jacksonville. Get it going. Bring the Bunker to Jacksonville.
All right. Thanks for your comment, Pat. Lots of talk about the redevelopment of the landing and what to do with that lately.
We actually had this story a week or so ago. Mm-hmm. I think we were first with it, maybe only with it. Entrepreneurial community is moving into the landing in a kind of really nicely concentrated, somewhat under the radar sort of way. Got a really good deal from Slaman Enterprises, who owns the place. It's still unclear what that means for the redevelopment, because basically it's like, I don't know, tenants moving into a derelict house, and then, you know, you have to figure out if we fix it or knock it down or whatever. But at the very least, it is building on that energy, which is trying to happen downtown.
All right. Also making headlines this week, the Duval County School Board approved this coming school year's code of conduct about how students are allowed to react when a fight breaks out. Students can now defend themselves in a fight by blocking attacks, but not necessarily fighting back. Mm. Superintendent Nikolai Vitti says students won't get in trouble for defending themselves during a fight. What do you think about the self-defense guidelines for our schools?
The first rule of Duval County schools is you don't talk about Duval County schools.
See, I was going to go with for the movie references. I was thinking more Karate Kid for some reason.
Yeah, I mean, seriously, though, you know, the code of conduct is a reaction to a lot of highly publicized fights. I mean, we see these fights on video.
Yep.
The school year's about to start. We saw what happened in May. A lot of, you know, fights that got on the local news, also school bus shootings. People are worried about public safety and schools, and the code of conduct is the best answer that they've got.
Have you read the code of conduct? Give us a call, 549-2937.
I have a tattoo to my back.
549-2937 if you have thoughts on fighting back, not fighting back, defending yourself. How do we know if someone is defending himself or fighting back?
I'm trying to figure out. Yeah. Who wants to be the guy watching the videos going, well, did he punch him in the arm, or was that blocking the other guy?
Yeah.
Right. I remember, you know, the old saying that it's basically the person defending themselves who starts the fight. Otherwise, you're just getting punched in the head. You know, if you defend yourself, now it's a fight. So,
yeah.
No, I mean, defending yourself is still mouthing off back at the person who mouthed off at you in the first place. Are you defending yourself at that point, or are you continuing to incite the argument? And of course, there's the problem the parents have. We're in the South again. I mean, if somebody hits you, buddy,
mm-hmm.
you better
Yeah, you best believe that.
You better, and don't come here and tell me that you didn't, and you let somebody get. I mean, there's a psychology in place here, and that this code of conduct also has to work with.
And also under the old policy, if you didn't fight back, you were getting suspended anyway, so you might as well, right?
That's right.
One issue this code of conduct is that it attributes a point system to things like fighting, to narcotics and alcohol violations and so forth. If you get up to 12 points, you get sent to an alternative school. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what this will allow them to do is basically get the quote-unquote bad apples or at-risk kids or whatever you want to call them out of the mainstream schools and into an alternative school that may have a salutary effect on things like achievement, on issues like that. It remains to be seen. But the code of conduct is clearly a way of, you know, trying to, you know, mainstream the mainstream schools and trying to get the people who are problematic out of them.
Yeah, and the policy is fight three times and you're out of the traditional school, I think VD said. Three times and you're out.
It's like three rounds. And then
Because, I mean, you recognize the kids are going to fight.
Right.
I mean, they're going to fight. You're going to get in at least, I mean, how many of us, how many fights did you get into when you were in high school? You're going to get into at least one or get around one.
The scars, man.
Except for, you know, for the nice people like Jessica who never got into anything.
Well, yeah, I was wondering where you were going with the, if your mouth off, is that starting a fight? Because, you know, mouthing off shouldn't be starting a fight. I mean, mouthing off is okay. Well, that was my childhood.
Well, it's called the dozens where I come from.
Yeah. You know, all right.
How well can you do it?
Larry, it's your turn to mouth off, Larry. Larry's calling from the north side. You're on the air. Larry?
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, I'm here. Good morning.
Well, I think, Larry, are you still there?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Do you have a question or a comment?
No, I really don't have a question. I guess a little comment regarding the edict that the superintendent of schools put out.
Okay.
You know, with the fight. So forth.
What do you think about it?
Well, it's sort of ridiculous to me because, I mean, the first law of nature is to defend yourself. And to me, it's just what's the point? You know?
All right. What's the point?
Well, I mean, really, there's liability issues at stake. If you have a fight and, you know, somebody gets a concussion out of it or something like that, somebody sues the school district, you know, you have liability issues related to that. There are all kinds of good reasons to have a policy like this. I mean, part of it is preventative, you know, and part of it is risk management, which is a big thing for a school district because their budget's tight.
You also have an interesting kind of like philosophical, cultural sort of thing. You know, Fred mentioned the idea of, you know, you there's the South, you're told to fight back sort of thing. But the just in general, that idea of do we really want to raise kids that if somebody, you know, is punching them in the head, that they just stand there? You know, that seems to not be the sort of way you want people to, you know, you don't necessarily want them to fight back. You don't want them to turn toward violence. But, you know, it seemed to be crossing a line to say, yeah, you know, just take it. Turn the other cheek.
Which is like, back in my day, if you were serious about it, you got off of school grounds and did it, you know, after school.
Yeah.
You know, meet me behind the gas station at 3:15 and let's go.
Oh, man. You know. Thanks, Larry. And we have one more call. Chuck is calling from the beaches. Good morning, Chuck. You're on the air.
Good morning. Basically, we already have laws in place on the street. And the laws that we have on the street determine who is the aggressor and who is not the aggressor. And it's, you know, felonies and misdemeanors and assaults, et cetera. And here's my question. If you have these things taking place in the school system or, say, at Publix grocery store, and it happens on a regular basis, you would think, and this is my question, why would not the standard legal system we have take place? And you mentioned lawsuits, you would think that a few lawsuits would put the school system in the same situation as a private industry. We cannot tolerate this kind of mess in our businesses. Why should it be tolerated in the school system? Thank you.
Thanks, Chuck.
Well, I think that's the issue, is that we recognize as a society, and we recognize it by law, that children underage children, and that's what we're talking about here, are treated differently. And of course, if these activities are happening on school grounds, which nowadays we have paid officers, certified police officers also in play, they can make that determination, that legal determination as to how far it's going to go. But we have decided as a society we're going to treat children differently, and that's what we're talking about here. I mean, psychologically, we already know. I mean, and this is the serious side of what the school board's having to wrestle with. Psychologically, they already know that we're dealing with immature minds who are not quite able to reason as they should be. And so they put in place some different rules to help them get through, because who you are in sixth grade is not who you're going to be in 10th grade, and it's probably not who you're going to be in 12th grade.
All right. We have Maria on the line from Putnam County. Good morning, Maria.
Hey, good morning to all. Oh, this is an issue that's not only in our school system, but it's outside of the school system. Anger, violence. Children see, 12 million violent sexual images before, you know, on the internet, just exposed to in the media. A lot of them see it at home. They're acting it out at school. We know this. It's a tragedy, and we want to sometimes make humorous comments about tragedies, but that should not be done from the venue of a round table. This is not funny. It's serious. And I think self-defense is a good idea. I'd like to see schools start teaching self-defense to the students, teaching peace, getting to the root of it. You see this at home? Is that why you want to whack Sally in the head? You know, there's like psychological issues involved. And but it's serious. Where's it going to go from here in another 20 years?
All right. Thank you for your comments, Maria. Teaching self-defense in schools, that's an idea.
That is an idea. Yeah. But, you know, I think the caller makes a point that's interesting, but at the same time, there have always been fights in schools. There always will be fights in schools. When you've got, you know, kids who are hormonally surging, when you've got confinement for 8 hours a day, when you've got people who are not totally invested in the educational process and the whole teaching to the test model that, you know, schools, basically embody now, you're going to have incidents like this. Kids get bored, they fight. And, you know, what the code of conduct says is that there are consequences. And the school district cannot raise these kids. That's got to happen at home. And I think that's the tacit understanding of the code of conduct.
All right. From fights in schools to fights over Florida's congressional districts about to happen in the Florida legislature and in court in the news this week, the Florida state legislature released a proposed congressional map ahead of special session next week. It's the first step in redrawing the districts to comply with an order from the Florida Supreme Court to make sure they don't violate anti-gerrymandering amendments again. This is the legislature's third attempt at drawing that map. First two were ruled unconstitutional. Two of the districts to be changed are partially in Northeast Florida, at least the fourth district represented by Andrew Crenshaw, and the fifth, the notorious fifth that snakes from Jacksonville down to Central Florida by Corrine Brown. But Congresswoman Brown went to court yesterday challenging the map, saying it would deny African Americans representation. What's going on here?
Well, I talked to Congresswoman Brown earlier this week before she filed the suit. She said that she had an announcement planned on Thursday. It was the lawsuit. She knew that it was going to be the East-West District. She's made the point that people in North Florida, that is, you know, to the west of Jacksonville, don't necessarily have much in common with Jacksonville. She's making the case to Jacksonville and Metro Orlando, you know, have linkages that Jacksonville doesn't initially have with the Lake City area or out toward Tallahassee, where the new district would draw. Mm-hmm. The new district does have a significant African-American population, around 48%. But, you know, to her, she looks at communities of interest as in the Voting Rights Act, and that's the argument she's making. And she's very comfortable with litigation this front. The reason she has her district in the first place was because she filed a suit back in the early 90s, way back when Bob Butterworth and Jim Smith were part of the Florida government, to make that happen. So, you know, she's fighting for that prerogative. So the state legislature may come up with a map, and it may be something that is challenged in court.
And if we do go with the map or something similar to the map that's released by the legislature that goes from Jacksonville just past Tallahassee, including parts of largely liberal Leon County.
Well, it splits Tallahassee. That's the big objection to it, because Tallahassee is split much in a way that Jacksonville is between Andrew and Corrine.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's really something that, you know, it's going to be a different political calculus for Representative Brown if that happens, because she's going to have to talk more to those issues out in North Florida, going to have to talk to a different constituency. But that being said, the district is very Democratic-leaning, and the bulk of Democrats in the district are Duval County. So, I mean, she'll be fine, but, you know, she's going to pursue this action anyway.
Does that put her up against another Democrat, Gwen Graham?
I think Gwen Graham is the big loser in this, because she's basically shifted to a Republican district, and this can be hard for her. She might be expedited into the Senate race. That being said, you know, she may face somebody from the Tallahassee area. But she's dealt with challenges time and time again, and Corrine is very hard to beat because she has a lot of support in the Congress, has a very active PAC, very good at fundraising, and is very good at distilling complex political arguments into sound bites.
And apparently she delivers.
Yeah, and she is a very strong politician. I mean, if you've seen her give a speech, if you've seen her give a press conference, she is a master, and she cannot be underestimated. She's been underestimated her entire career.
I think that's an important point. The idea there is a segment of Jacksonville that very much does not like her, but there's a very strong, she has a very strong base of support, and she's very good at the job of politicking.
Yeah. I mean, and really she gets reduced to a caricature a lot, you know, by the mainstream media, you know, by a lot of the people who hate her. They reduce her to a caricature, and, you know, it's racialist in a lot of ways because, you know, they use very objectionable characterizations of Congresswoman Brown. And that's something that is always under the surface of a lot of commentary on Corrine Brown.
Well, you go back to we talk about the dredging, the port deepening. I mean, the authorization for that, you know, came, there was a lot of people involved, and I'm not saying that it was just, you know, Corrine, but she was very instrumental in getting that done. And you have a lot of people who are, not that she shies away from the spotlight, but you have a lot of people trying to claim the credit for that, and she's very instrumental in actually doing something like that that her district wants.
And from the legislative standpoint, of course, they're under pressure and a deadline to get this done. They've got to get it out by, the 25th of September and get this back out of their hands and back to so the judge can review it. So there are some deadlines that have to be dealt with here, and that's just moving through. But this lawsuit will probably be still going on by Christmas.
Yep. And we need to mention a quick update moving on here to two tragic cases here in Jacksonville. On Monday, the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office canceled the Amber Alert for 21-month-old Lonzi Barton, who was reported missing almost 2 weeks ago now. Police say they have evidence the toddler was killed. They're now treating the case as a murder investigation. At the same time, the Justice Coalition is offering a $7,000 reward or more possibly now for information about the shooting of an employee behind the Blind Rabbit restaurant in Riverside that happened July 22nd as he was taking out the trash. Two men are believed to have robbed Daniel Rowe before shooting him. So a couple of unsolved murders here in Jacksonville, adding to the list of unsolved murders.
Yeah, and you know, the Lonzi Barton case is horrible. It just is. And I think Mark Woods made a really good point last week in a column saying that, you know, Lonzi Barton was behind the eight ball from go. I mean, his mother works in the adult entertainment industry. He was being taken care of by a caretaker who's more interested in, you know, his drug habit than actually looking after the kid and so forth. And, you know, it was shaping up very badly from jump for Lonzi Barton. The Daniel Rowe case, and, you know, on the other hand, it looks to be at this point a simple robbery. You know, what kind of calculus goes into robbing somebody who's taking out the garbage at a restaurant? You know, how much money would that person have? It just indicates, you know, that Riverside, even though it's gentrified, it's still got a long way to go, because once you get up past Post Street, past College Street, the neighborhood deteriorates. It's not quite so gentrified, and you do have that culture clash. And the Blind Rabbit is something that's supposed to mean making the neighborhood nicer. Yeah. But, you know, that comes in fits and starts. It's not a smooth process.
I think that's part of the reason why that case just has so galvanized people. I mean, one, obviously, it's a tragedy. Any human life, this person seems to be particularly beloved, but also there is that idea that this was one of the restaurants that was helping shape the area, and you know, it's like, how can you do that to a place like this or near a place like this?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, a bullet does not discriminate. You know, and that's really the thing. It's like a lot of these crimes are getting a lot of attention in part because the victims are white. I mean, that's a reality of it, because we see crime and, you know, African-American victims all the time. They don't get nearly this amount of coverage.
All right. And turning to national news now, the first 2016 Republican presidential debate was held last night in Cleveland. We're going to open this up with a call. Paul has been waiting patiently on the line throughout the entire show. Paul from Orange Park, you are on the air.
Yeah, well, I was calling about the fiasco, otherwise known as the Republican scramble for a candidate. I would think that with 17 candidates, no independent voter is going to vote Republican. Mitt Romney kind of proved that if you flaunt your wealth, you know, you pretty much shoot yourself in the foot. Donald Trump is making the Republican Party look like idiots. And unless and until the Republican Party gets their act together and comes to a, you know, conclusion about a candidate that they can put their full weight behind, I don't think they have any chance of getting elected, no matter who runs on the Democratic side.
Thanks for your comments, Paul. The front runner in the polls going into the debate last night was billionaire businessman and reality TV star Donald Trump. So, guys, how did the Donald do last night against the nine politicians in the debate?
You know, Donald Trump was amazing to watch. I mean, it was a great spectacle. He's basically running against the Koch brothers machine, running against Fox News. He was the guy who got the hard personal questions last night, and by and large, he dealt with them as well as he could. Asked about corporate bankruptcies, asked about shifting positions, asked about, you know, issue after issue, while the other guys got policy softballs. And, you know, Donald Trump, you know, his negatives might have gone up last night, but I don't think it's going to hurt his positives in the polls. But this is something we were talking about before the show, is like, what kind of ceiling does Donald Trump have? In a 17-way race, he looks pretty good because he's got that, you know, 20 to 25%, depending on the poll. What does it look like when it's down to three or four candidates, when, you know, your Chris Christie's and your Mike Huckabee's and these people peel off and go and do their shows on Fox News? What happens then? That's the question. But for now, Donald Trump is the straw that stirs the drink. And what it indicates is that there is a real death of ideas in the Republican Party. The conservative movement is on life support, and Donald Trump is spotlighting that.
Well, I find it interesting how he's kind of taken up the space that otherwise would be kind of, I don't know, call it the half entertainer, half political, you know, a Huckabee and a Christie. Their thing is the straight talking, you know, fun to watch sort of thing. I mean, Huckabee did perfectly well at the debate because Huckabee does well at debates. Huckabee is not going to be the nominee. But Trump kind of is taking away, you know, what's the point in having Trump and Christie in a way? Christie isn't quite as fun as Trump, and it's not like that you're going to get huge policy debates.
All right, going to the phone. Jeff in St. Augustine. Jeff, did you watch the debate last night?
Yeah, I watched the second half of it. And, you know, I'd have to say, as a fairly liberal person, you know, I like John Kasich a lot. I'm not sure that I would vote for him if it was between Hillary and John Kasich, but I think I would definitely give it some thought. And you know, I mean, he has right-sided ideological, you know, positions, but I mean, he's a reasonable, very likable guy. And, you know, I think that if he is not the nominee, the Republican Party is really doing themselves a disservice. And the second comment I wanted to make was, unfortunately, if Hillary Clinton is the nominee and, you know, this Planned Parenthood thing is still all in the mix, it's going to unfortunately be like a one-issue election. And there's certainly a lot more issues that need to be discussed and need to be debated. So I hope that, you know, some of this kind of dies down by the time of the general election.
All right. Thanks for your comments, Jeff. Fred, do you think this Planned Parenthood thing is going to factor into the race?
Not any more than anything else. I mean, it's still the Planned Parenthood issue just comes back to the same old argument of abortion or not abortion. I mean, that's what it comes down to. I mean, that's the whole pursuit of this thing, is to weed out by those on the right, weed out any suggestion, any mention, any funding of anything that has to do with abortion. And unfortunately, these videos, these undercover videos, are designed to get at anybody who has anything to do with it. And Planned Parenthood just happens to be on the radar at this point in time. But it's not going to be any other major issue, any major than any other abortion argument has been over the last 20 years of presidential elections. I mean, abortion is illegal in this country. There's nothing the president's going to be able to do about it unless the Congress goes along with it, and the Congress is not going to go along with it. So why are you continuing to go along with this?
The suggestion was Huckabee last night, who basically said executive orders to just, you know, overturn Roe v. Wade. The Planned Parenthood thing is going to be an issue in the primary, as everybody tries to outright each other, but in the general.
This is a
fundraising
gimmick.
Guys, we
got to
move on now. Now, finally, it's our look at the strange, bizarre, and plain ridiculous from this week across the state. Luckily, never a shortage of material. Here, right now, only in Florida. Only in Florida do people interrupt TV weather reports by catching fish with their bare hands. Reporters from ABC Action News in Tampa were covering the heavy flooding in one of the city's main roads when they noticed something, well, fishy going on. A local resident was splashing around in the middle of the street trying to catch a fish caught in the floodwaters, and he succeeded. Lucky for us, ABC Action News kept their cameras rolling. You can see that video on their site. The man took a quick photo with the fish before dropping it, apparently because it bit him.
That's the best part of the story.
Only in Florida do people under arrest try to chew off their fingerprints to avoid being ID'd. Lee County Sheriff's detectives pulled over 20-year-old Kenzo Roberts last week after spotting him driving a stolen Mercedes. They detained him after they found he was using a fake ID, had a concealed weapon, and several fraudulent credit cards. While he was in the back of the patrol car, a surveillance camera caught Roberts trying to remove his fingerprints by chewing them off and rubbing them against the cage. That tactic did not work, by the way. A fingerprint scanner quickly identified him. Roberts had two felony warrants out for his arrest and was also found to be in the country illegally.
That's going to be a big one there. That's the big deal right there.
Who hasn't tried to chew off their fingerprints, though? I mean.
And finally, only in Florida do satirical Twitter accounts inspire art shows. Every summer, the nonprofit Locust Project in Miami hands over its gallery to high school art students. The kids have 3 weeks to create an exhibition around a theme. This year's theme, the popular Florida Man Twitter account, chronicling weird news from the Sunshine State. Among the artwork pieces are pieces inspired by legendary Florida stories like Florida Man pulls kid's tooth by tying it to Chevy Camaro and driving away, and Florida Man assaults brother with bowl of chicken, a classic. The exhibition is free and open to the public, but you have to act fast because it closes on Sunday. That's only in Florida for
only
today.
Only in Miami.
Thank you to our media panel, A.G. Gankarski, Tim Gibbons, and Fred Matthews. Thank you guys so much for being here.
Thank you.
Have a great weekend.
Thank you. And much more is still ahead on First Coast Connect. Up next, UF Health's pediatrics director has a checklist for kids getting ready for the new school year. We'll be right back.
If you love All Things Considered, consider joining us a few hours early for Afternoons on WJCT. The Takeaway offers a fresh way to look at the news, featuring critical conversations, reports from the field, and listener participation. That's followed by The World, with engaging voices to illuminate what's going on around the globe and why it matters to you. It's the smart way to spend your afternoons. Weekdays from 2 to 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Fresh Air...
Here is the secret of a master manipulator and liar. They leave lots of blanks for you to fill in.
Walter Kern was conned by a man he thought was his friend. He claimed to be a Rockefeller and dropped hints about his prestige and power. But he was an imposter who years before had murdered and buried a young man. Kern's book is Blood Will Out. Join us.
Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
Welcome back to First Coast Connect. I'm Jessica Palumbo, in for Melissa Ross. The start of the new school year is coming up fast, and doctors say now is an excellent time for parents to make sure their child's healthy and ready to head back. Dr. Jennifer Knight, Medical Director of UF Health Pediatrics, joins us now with a few tips every parent should know. Dr. Knight, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. So it's the start of the school year. Parents are thinking about their child's wellness heading into the first day of school. Mm-hmm. So what recommendations do you have to make sure that your child's ready for school?
Well, the school year should be fun for kids, and keeping them healthy both physically and mentally should be a priority for both parents and for the children's pediatrician and or family physicians. So now is the best time to schedule back-to-school physicals and ensure that immunizations are up to date and that your child has had their hearing and vision screened and any age-appropriate developmental assessments.
All right. So how often should a parent take their child to just get a regular old physical when they're not sick?
Well, we recommend that you bring your child in annually, which sometimes slips our mind if we have healthy children. Mm-hmm. But it's an excellent opportunity for your child's physician to really get to know you as a family and really get to know your child and his or her medical history. It's great for building that long-term continuity of care.
Sure. And yeah. Part of that includes immunizations. What are the key ages that parents need to keep in mind for immunizations?
So there are a lot of key ages when we are talking about immunizations in general, but specifically for back-to-school immunizations, age 4 is a time where children may be going to VPK, and that's a big year for getting some immunizations when they get their boosters for MMR and chickenpox, mm-hmm. As well as some others. And another key age is age 11, when they need their Tdap booster, and that's the age at which they can get the HPV vaccine series started, as well as the meningitis vaccine.
So 11 years old for the HPV vaccine. That sounds young.
It does sound young, but it's important to actually have that vaccine given while they're young so that immunity is in place long before they're ever exposed or potentially exposed to that virus.
And that's usually a sexually transmitted virus?
It usually is, yes. Mm-hmm. But I think it's more important to think about that vaccine as being cancer prevention, because mm-hmm. that's really what it is. And again, you know, we give it up until about age 26. So after that age, it's not offered anymore right now. So it's very important for that to be given while children are young so that immunity is set long before it becomes an issue.
And you mentioned it's not only about physical health, but also developmental and mental health. What are some things parents should keep in mind about making sure that that's all on track, going the way it should be going?
Well, that's part of the annual physical exam with the physician. It's a longer appointment where we talk about developmental and emotional concerns, whether normal or abnormal, and address them. But another thing to keep in mind is that going back to school is a very stressful event for children. Even though it's exciting, it's stressful because it's new and it's anxiety provoking. So one of the ways to sort of ease your child back into the school year is to go ahead and establish your routine, your bedtime routine, the morning routine, if it includes breakfast at home, kind of walking your child through what a typical school day is going to be like, whether it means, you know, the route that they walk or drive in the morning, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. And going back into the school environment, mm-hmm. is that a time when more children get sick because they're around other children?
Definitely. That's obviously a big risk factor for infections, and in particular, the seasonal flu season, right, that happens mm-hmm. usually, we see it as early as October, but typically peaks between December and February. So the flu vaccine isn't available right now, but that's something to talk to your child's pediatrician about to determine when your child can receive it to help keep them healthy throughout the school year.
Okay. Any other tips for back to school?
Well, I think one of the things that's being discussed a lot now that's very much in the public eye is the issue of bullying and things like that. So I think it's very important to create a safe environment for your child to talk about things that stress them out at school. There are a lot of things that will happen through the school year that are beyond their control, whether it be bullying or unrealistic performance expectations. Mm-hmm. So just trying your best as a parent to help your child learn age-appropriate techniques for dealing with stress and having an open environment conducive to talking about it.
Yeah, not holding those feelings inside.
Right, exactly.
Thank you so much. This is Dr. Jennifer Knight, Medical Director of UF Health Pediatrics. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. It's UF Health Pediatrics North.
UF Health Pediatrics North.
Yes,
thank you so much. And in just a moment, the Jacksonville Zoo and Gardens celebrates sharks this weekend. We'll be right back with more First Coast Connect after this.
New name, new look. Join us for our annual Women's Health Conference, Girls Day Out, August 15th, Hyatt Regency Hotel. Morning keynote speaker, mental health advocate Jessie Close, who wants to change how people talk and think about mental illness. An ambassador for Bring Change to Mind, a not-for-profit organization founded by Jessie's sister, actress Glenn Close. Jessie fights stigma and misunderstandings to create a clearer picture of mental disorders. Good for you. Girls Day Out is hosted by Baptist Health and WJCT. For a complete list of speakers or to purchase your tickets, log on to wjct.org/goodforyou.
WJCT and the Florida Theater are proud to bring me, Michael Feldman, and my show, What Do You Know, to the Florida Theater in Jacksonville on February 20th. Tickets available now at the Florida Theater box office by phone at 904-355-2787 or online at floridatheater.com.
Welcome back to First Coast Connect. I'm Jessica Palumbo, sitting in for Melissa Ross. Finally, this hour, this weekend, the Jacksonville Zoo and Gardens is hosting some of the world's leading experts on sharks to discuss research and efforts to save the animals worldwide. The North Florida Shark Festival, A Conversation with a Bite, takes place tonight and tomorrow at the zoo. Peggy Sloan is the executive director of the North Carolina Aquarium. She's a guest speaker at the Shark Festival tomorrow, and right now she joins us in studio. Good morning, Peggy. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for having me this morning.
Yes, thank you. It seems like people are kind of obsessed with sharks these days, so where do you think that fascination comes from?
I think a lot of places. They're beautiful, interesting predators. They've been around on the planet for a very long time, and they're a little bit scary. I think we always have a fascination with things that we respect and fear.
Right. Did you see that video of the guy in the surfing competition recently who was bitten by a shark and he punched the shark to get it away from him?
I'm not familiar with that. Are you referring to the one in Australia?
Yes.
He wasn't actually bitten. The fascinating thing about that is he startled the shark. The shark got caught up in his leash, his surfboard leash, and the media spun it to be an attack, and it actually was that poor shark was just minding his own business, and the surfer surfed over him, and the shark swam away as soon as the surfer got out of the water.
The shark was framed.
That's right.
So that gets to my next point, that sharks are misunderstood creatures.
Absolutely.
Yes, especially with shark attacks in the news, or supposed shark attacks. So can you tell us how sharks fit into the ocean ecosystem and why they're important?
They're so important. They are top predators. So they are responsible for maintaining the balance throughout the ocean ecosystem. A good example in our waters in the Northwest Atlantic, the removal of large sharks, these large predators, led to an increase in some stingray species, cow-nose rays to be specific. And that in turn led to a collapse of the bay scallop fishery. So if you like to eat scallops, you've got to take it easy on sharks.
Wow, I love scallops.
Don't
we
all?
I had no idea. So what are some common myths about sharks?
Well, one, that they have any interest in attacking people at all. Most cases of people encountering sharks getting bitten, it's mistaken identity.
Okay.
We're out there swimming in their kitchen during lunch hour. You're likely going to get bit. Not likely, very unlikely actually to get bit, but that's how it happens. That they're not looking to interact with people. It happens. It's usually an accident.
Yeah, because you just happen to be in their neighborhood.
Wrong place at the wrong time.
Yeah. So Can you tell us about some of the research and conservation efforts that are happening at your aquarium?
Sure, I'd be happy to. We are trying to learn more about the sand tiger shark, which is a threatened species. Mm. You see them a lot in aquariums. They're also called ragtooth sharks. They can't actually close their mouth enough to hide their teeth. They look really fearsome. They grow very large, but they're very docile. Mm-hmm. And we don't know a whole lot about them. A lot of people come to North Carolina to dive on our shipwrecks. You should try it. It's wonderful. And these large groups of sand tiger sharks live on these wrecks. The divers go down, routinely are among hundreds of sharks, 7 to 8 foot sharks, no problem. Mm-hmm. But we don't know where they are when they're not at the wrecks, and we don't know what we can do to ensure that they are protected in the future. So we're doing a lot of research now to better understand them.
I'm picturing Finding Nemo in my head right now as you're describing a shipwreck with a shark.
That's right.
All right. So this weekend at the Jacksonville Zoo and Gardens, you will be here educating more people about sharks and your work and myths and misconceptions. When will you be speaking?
I will be speaking during lunch tomorrow at the Shark Festival, along with Captain Brett McBride, who captains the OSearch research vessel. If you have tracked Mary Lee, Catherine, those white sharks that we follow, he's the captain of that vessel. He'll be there tomorrow, as well as doing a lecture tonight.
And just a little bit more about the festival. It starts this evening at the Jacksonville Zoo and Gardens. I understand there's music and more lectures. Anything else you want people to know about it?
Please go to jacksonvillezoo.org to find information about that event and how to get tickets. It's going to be a blast, and you don't want to miss the inaugural event.
All right. Thank you so much. That's Peggy Sloan, Executive Director of the North Carolina Aquarium. She'll be part of the Jacks Zoo and Gardens North Florida Shark Fest happening this weekend. More at jacksonvillezoo.org. Thank you for being here.
Thanks again for the opportunity. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you. And that is our program, folks. Thanks to all of our guests and all of our callers. The show's producer is Sean Birch. Theme song is composed and performed by Pyotr Chevchik. If you missed a show this week, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. I'm Jessica Palumbo. You're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT Jacksonville. Melissa Ross will be back Monday morning at 9 a.m. Have a great weekend, everyone.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.